opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Welcome, welcome. We're glad you could make it. You're just in time for the Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Cat Cloco, Ceiling Cat, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould. In our comfy live chat room here at para-x.com, enjoy our various paranormal investigator guests, mediums, authors, cryptozoologists, psychics, ufologists, etc. So sit back, relax with us and the Paranormal View.
And welcome, everybody, to the Paranormal View right here on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight. In a lot of places, it's pretty chilly, so we just hope you're bundled up and got some coffee or whatever and sitting back and ready to listen to the show tonight. We do want to, again, thank you for taking the time to do that. And for those listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you and glad that you are taking the time to listen. If you're not with us here in the chat room, you feel free to come on over, para-x.com, click on the live chat button, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people and you'll be able to interact with them and with us and ask questions of our guests. But if you decide not to come into the chat room, you can still ask questions. You can send us a question to theparanormalview@gmail.com, and we will get the questions right over to our guest tonight. And we have with us Cat Cloco.
Hello, and greetings, my Massachusetts Independent Comic Expo peeps.
And we have Barbara Duncan with us.
Hey, greetings from California.
And unfortunately, Jeff is not going to be with us tonight because he is on a filming assignment somewhere out of California. So we wish him good luck with that. And he should, I don't know, I don't think he's back next week either, is he?
I think he's gone.
I think he's gone next week also. So
yep.
Anyway, tonight we got a wonderful guest with us. And I'm just going to go ahead and just let Kat go ahead and introduce our guest.
Okay, so instead of Jeff, tonight I will be doing the bio. So our guest tonight is Thomas White, who is a university archivist and curator of the special collections at... Oh man, I just forgot it. Please say it for me, Thomas.
Duquesne
University. Thank you. He is also an adjunct lecturer at Duquesne's history department and an adjunct professor of the history at La Roche College. White received a master's degree in public history from Duquesne University. Besides the folklore and history of Pennsylvania, his areas of interest include public history and American cultural history. He is an award-winning author of 10 books, including Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, Ghosts of Southwestern Pennsylvania, Gangs and Outlaws of Western Pennsylvania, co-authored with Michael Hassett, Witches of Pennsylvania, Occult History and Lore, Supernatural Lore of Pennsylvania, Ghosts, Monsters, and Miracles, and Haunted Roads of Western Pennsylvania, co-authored with Tony Lavorne. So welcome to our show, Jeff. You're not Jeff. Thomas. Oh, man. This is why Jeff does this role.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes.
It's going to be one of them nights. I can see
it all. It is.
Yes. We do want to thank you, Thomas, for taking time to be with us tonight. As you can tell, he's got a lot of books, and we're going to have lots of different topics to talk about. And
yeah.
Over, so I know we won't even get halfway through anything, but we're going to give it a shot and have a great time doing it. with that, I want to go ahead and I asked you before we got on the air, but you have been to most of the places that you've written about.
Yes, I kind of purposely focus on Pennsylvania as kind of like a case study area because I live in Pennsylvania. I'm from Pittsburgh. And I figure, you know, I could do, you know, a whole bunch of kind of national type cases, but I thought, let's just focus on Pennsylvania. That way I can drive everywhere and check it out. You know, I can do the research. As a professional historian, I like to do like the real historical research behind every site, every place I go. And then I can collect oral histories, and I can build up a collection over time where I can interview some people one week and another and get different generations about legends and ghost stories of people and get their information. Then I can go to all these places and really spend time at them and you know, check them out, see what they're really like. And, you know, it helps kind of narrowing geographic focus helps me with my research and makes it a lot easier.
Well, now, with your book, Haunted Roads of West Pennsylvania. There was one, I guess it was, that you had written about, and it was called Blue Mist Road. Now, the ones in this particular book, is that mainly areas like that's outside roads and different things like that?
Yeah, it's mostly kind of like outdoor roads. In fact, they all have, one thing I noticed kind of studying these legends about these certain roads, and like the same techniques we ended up using in that book could be applied to roads in Ohio or West Virginia or New Jersey or anywhere else. But what we did is we looked at a variety of roads that had different characteristics, and we looked at kind of just the stories of the roads in general. And we looked at the background of them. You know, these roads have many stories told over the years, and there's some of what is told about them is urban legends, and some of it's based on real things that happened. Mm-hmm. And some of the legends are kind of a reaction to different things going on in American culture, too. So there's, like, many different things going on in any one of these places. And we try to pick all the little pieces apart and look at all the little aspects of the legend. But they're all very common. And in fact, the roads themselves exist, and this is kind of where I differ from some other investigators, because I've done a lot of kind of academic ideas, but I don't trap myself by them, you know. I don't feel, you know, bound to them, but the folklorists would call, like, places where haunted roads are, they use the term liminal. They're a liminal space. They're spaces of, like, transition, so they're often kind of, like, out on the edge of the suburbs before you get to, like, the rural areas, or, like, in places where people would normally go in their day-to-day routine. They're places of either physical or psychological transition. And, you know, if you think about a lot of alleged haunted roads that are out there, they're always in places just beyond, you know, your day-to-day kind of world. But you can still, they're not too far away. You can drive to them. You know, you can get there. They're not that hard to find. But they're often kind of on the fringes of places. And that kind of adds to the kind of the ambiance of the road, and it's one of the draws of these places, because they're a little more isolated. They do seem creepy, and they attract people.
Yeah. Now, actually, before we really get into a lot of the stories with the roads, what I found really interesting with the first few chapters of your haunted roads of Western Pennsylvania was that you talk about really a lot of the theory that goes into folklore, the study of folklore. And what I liked was that you brought up Bill Ellis and his take on the life stages of a legend, which I know never really talk about on this show. But it's really interesting and actually kind of important for us to know, especially since I know so many of our listeners are paranormal investigators or at least paranormal enthusiasts. So if I'm not putting you on the spot here, Thomas, can you go through the stages for our listeners of what folklore goes through? Like, how do we find these legends? What make, not quite urban legends, but just these legends, their lifespan, basically.
Sure. And it's important to remember that folklorists call all, you know, folklorists now, what we tend to call, and I'll preface this by saying, you know, let's say people are interested in the paranormal. And I do this, too. I make two categories. I have what's called, like, the true ghost stories, which are definitely based on something that really happened. And I have urban legends, which are kind of the false ghost stories that we've all heard of, like the Hook Man and stuff like that, you know. But they tend to carry, like, moral warnings, you know. They're like an urban legend. So there's, like, those two categories that most people, you know, will often divide them into. But for folklorists, it's all a legend because they're not trying to prove whether it's real or not. They're just looking at them as folklore. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, when they look at the legend, one of the things they do is, you know, in the past, especially before the internet, you know, one of the things you look at is how a legend's communicated, because that's important. Mm-hmm. And so in the past, you know, what happened is, you know, say you went to a place, and I'm kind of, I apologize on the off chance Bill Ellis would be listening. I'm probably going to butcher the delivery of his explanation. But, you know, say, you know, the first stage in a legend is actually when you go to a place and have an experience and you kind of put a name to it. Like the first person, you mentioned mm-hmm. Blue Mist Road before, the first person that went to Blue Mist Road called it Blue Mist Road and mm-hmm. said it was haunted. That'd be kind of the naming of the experience. Mm-hmm. And obviously if they thought it was haunted, something weird happened there. So that first couple groups of people that come back from that place with a new experience, they tell a story, and what the folklorists call telling the ghost story, the narratives. So they tell the narrative of a story, you know, usually in kind of you know, it's certainly the first-hand account of how they experienced it. And it's kind of a broken form, as, you know, many times when you explain something the first time, it's not polished and smooth. But then after the group tells it multiple times, you know, say it's a kid from a high school, for example, and he's telling a trend. So the first time it's kind of rough. But then they talk about it for a while, and they tell other friends. It becomes more polished. And that's kind of the height of the ghost story, where all the details are included, and it's very polished, and they've told it multiple times. And, of course, you know, you're telling you as part of the legend. Well, then over time, though, that same group, you know, you can only tell the ghost story to people that know it so many times. And then what happens is it becomes what they call a kernel narrative, where it's a shorter version of the legend. We just mentioned the high points. You know, occasionally if you bring it up again or there's an outsider that you don't want to explain the whole legend to, but you can tell them little pieces. It's important just to get the gist across or to say, you know, if you're trying to tell it quickly. But after a while, when everybody's familiar with the legend, then it becomes just like a little remnant or a fragment of the legend where you say, oh, yeah, there's a road out there in North Park. It's haunted. There were some people killed there, and there's a hanging tree. They call it Blue Mist Road. You know, and that's it. That's all you get.
Right.
And in the past, what happened is folklorists had to capture, if you didn't capture the legend at the height, then you were stuck with one of these small narratives at the end. But what happened over time, you know, people like me come along, and, you know, we hear now, you know, at least in the past, especially people would write those ghost, like local ghost story books, and they'd capture one version of the narrative and write it down. Now, what that did is it would trap the ghost story in one form, but then it would be spread to a larger audience because it would be in a book. But then, you know, and so that's how it was for many years. If you were researching folklore, you had to get these stories directly from people, or you got them on a book, or you got them from a book, which was a very polished, finished form. But, you know, but it was a static form that wouldn't evolve and change. And what most people forget, even with ghost stories, we may even think that are true, they still change a little bit over time. Now, the thing that really has affected folklore, and actually has made it much easier to study, though in the beginning people thought it would make it more difficult, it's the internet. And what happens is now, in the internet, all those stages that, like Bill Ellis defined, you know, for the traditional oral transition of folklore, they all survive simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you go online, like, for example, I was researching Blue Mist Road, and I talked to these people, and, you know, you can talk to somebody that heard the legend in the 1970s, and they have their version that's on there, say, on a Facebook page. And then somebody that heard it in the 80s puts their version on. And they said, yeah, when I was in high school in 1983, this is what we heard. Mm-hmm. And somebody that was there in 1995 says what they heard. And you notice they're all a little bit different. They still may have the same basic core, but there's new layers added on over time. And so, you know, there's one ghost story, then there's a second ghost story, and there's a third and a fourth, and they're all about the same road. And they just keep stacking on top of each other. And then what happens is, you know, on the internet, then you get this whole array, and you see different time periods and different people talking about the legend as it evolves. And then what you can do is you can take it and kind of spread out the legend and match it with its other things going on locally in local history. You can verify events. You know, you can, you know, look at larger cultural scares and panics. And then, you know, then on top of it, you know, you can see if you can figure out if it's really haunted. If that's what you want to do, you know.
Right.
And so you can, you know, folklore lets you put a context to the ghost story you hear.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me a lot when I was studying the Bloody Mary legend in the Midwest and how that changed just from between Indiana and Michigan, and you go up into Wisconsin and Illinois, just how it goes from sometimes Bloody Mary appears with a knife in the older versions. In the mirror, she shows up with a knife, and then eventually she's gouging your eyes out with her fingernails, and the number of times you have to say her name, and the number of candles, the color of candles, the time of day or night. It just starts getting more elaborate as it's spread and as it gets into our more contemporary times. And now, I think you have to do a hoedown in your bathroom in order to summon Bloody Mary. So.
And that's it. The legends become more complicated because people do them. They think, well, you know, and the other thing is the legend has more steps and it's more complicated. And there's an excuse as to why it doesn't work because you didn't do it right.
Right, exactly.
You know, say you go and you try to do it and nothing happens. Well, we must have done something wrong. But at the same time, the legends also become more violent. This is something I've noticed from studying folklore for the past, you know, 16 or 17 years, is that there was definitely a shift in American society around, like, 1975.
Yeah.
There was a whole variety of things, but there was, you know, kind of a cultural shift where America became more conservative again, reacting to the excesses of the late 60s, and there's a whole variety of things. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I mean, people know what happened. You know, you had the rise of the conservative movement in America that pushed, like, Ronald Reagan into office. But, you know, like, if you look at that, I mean, from the late 60s, like I said, from 69 to, or 70 to 80, there was a huge cultural shift in America.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that happened with that, you know, certainly was this, and part of it was based on legitimate things. Some of it was overreaction, but there was this increased perceived threat of violence children and the young people. And what happened is, you know, one thing I noticed studying all these legends over the years, I've studied hundreds and hundreds of legends, is these ones that go back very far, by around the mid-70s, they all turn much darker and more violent.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, so, you know, I imagine, I haven't researched Bloody Mary, but I wonder if you put it on a, you know, timeline, you'd see, especially by the time you got to the 80s, and you know, that's the versions I remember hearing, is where she claws your eyes out, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you look like parallel to that in the media, you have all this coverage starting around the mid-70s through the 80s of, like, serial killers. Mm-hmm. That's when, you know, the Halloween candy supposedly had razor blades in it.
Yeah.
And all that stuff, you know, there's all those cases, but it just kind of reflects things going on in culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't it rather cyclical, though, when you see the old Germanic fairy tales, for example, which are extremely violent in nature?
Yes.
And then it goes to a more passive, almost friendly atmosphere of fairy tales, and then now back to urban legends, which are tending to get more violent again.
Yes, you do see that cycle, and I, you know, it does repeat over time. I mean, if you go back, you know, part of it is, I think we see it especially now in Americans, you know, American culture. I mean, we're all pretty comparatively sheltered. If you look at our ancestors in the late 1800s, I mean, there's not too many of us anymore in America that have to go out and kill your food every day,
right?
You know, or do something that's actually pretty violent, you know what I mean? And to do is really hard. I mean, there's still plenty of people that do, but it's, you know what I mean? It's we've kind of been sheltered and removed from death, and people, you know, we have more hospitals and we live longer. If you think back, you know, even 150 years ago, I mean, mm-hmm. death. People were walking with death on a daily basis much more closely than we seem to be, you know?
Yeah.
And, but, you know, then you know, things do go through this cycle, though. And, you know, there's things in society that scare people, and they go up and down and up and down. And you know, kind of, they say there's nothing new under the sun, and that's kind of true in many ways, you know, with these things.
Yeah, what struck me as interesting, and I haven't come across this before, I grew up in Northern Indiana and in the 80s and 90s, and I didn't hear a lot of satanic cult stuff, but I've moved out here to Rhode Island, and in just about 20 minutes north of me is a wonderful place called the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And it is loaded with all these cult stories, and it's opened my mind to all this new direction of folklore, and I'm like, what is this mystical place known as the Bridgewater Triangle? And it goes hand in hand with the cult panic that you talk about in the book, but this is something that completely passed me by in northern Indiana.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there are certain parts of the country, and that guy, one of the first guys to dub it the Satanic Panic back in 1993, a sociologist named Jeffrey Victor. Mm-hmm. He kind of charted out, you know, he was looking mainly at like Ohio, Pennsylvania, I think mm-hmm. West Virginia and New York, but he has some great maps in his book. And actually, mm-hmm. you know, the studies he did overlap exactly with where I recorded a lot of these stories.
Yeah.
And it was weird. He like tracked it to certain regions.
Yeah.
And it'd be a pocket in one area, and then like, you know, the area next to it would have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And no, he wasn't, obviously, he was just, you know, kind of doing his own legwork. I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure he'd admit it wasn't entirely precise because it's hard to track any of that. But
right.
You know, even Bill Ellis found pockets when he did his research.
Mm-hmm.
I know certainly I found areas where it's very, very concentrated. Then you go, you know, 30 miles away and there's nothing.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But it's interesting, and it did, you know, had a real impact. You know, one thing I found, there's certain things I've found that have emerged in all these legends, these haunted, supposedly haunted road places. You know, often there's two groups that always emerge, seems,
mm-hmm.
and it's the Ku Klux Klan and Satanists.
Right.
In addition to the mm-hmm. ghosts, but they are also creating their own ghosts by killing people,
sure.
and doing black magic ceremonies, and you know, so it adds more layers, but they're more sinister layers to the legend.
You could also say
they're
the
almost
same
like
as alien abductions and cryptozoology
yeah.
sightings. They tend to fall yeah. into certain patterns, but it's patchworked across the United States. We don't see a lot of Satanism in California, surprisingly enough.
Yeah.
Wait, don't you have this Satanist house out there that's all black?
Yeah, but it's not the in the woods torturing animals, children,
that's
extremely like that. It's a completely
yeah.
different outlook on Satanism or witchcraft, for example, than you would have,
mm-hmm.
say, on the East Coast.
True. Yeah, it's the interesting thing with when I was doing my book tour, I kind of tricked, I've told this story before to our listeners, so they're going to be like, oh no. I tricked my listening audience to kind of show them how disconnected from nature they were. I was talking about Crybaby Bridges, and I played two audio files that I said I captured at a Crybaby Bridge. And in fact, these audio files had been captured by a friend of mine who is a wildlife expert, different expert. And and one was a screech owl, and the other one was fox kits. And they both sound exactly like human babies crying. And I played them, and the people went nuts. They're like, that's exactly, like, one woman lived near what was a quote-unquote crybaby bridge. And she's like, that's exactly what I hear, the babies crying every single night. And it's always, like, in the springtime. And I think it's a residual haunting. And I revealed that it was fox kits crying. And she's like, oh. And I thought she'd be really mad at me, because let's be honest, that was a very devious thing that I did. But she kind of liked the fact that there was an explanation, a very real-world explanation, and it showed the group how disconnected to the sounds of nature they were. And I always find that as a very interesting situation I found myself in. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's the thing when you investigate this stuff, and that's why I often end up working alone
yeah.
much of my career, is that I, you know, I come from kind of an academic background, but I'm not a disbeliever. It's just, I think
mm-hmm.
if you really want to find the truth, you have to be willing to admit that, you know, good 80 to 90% of the time, there's just a regular explanation for things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then when you really get one of those odd times, where that's when you have something, you know, that's really good, but you have to look at many things. You know, I've been in places where you hear noises, you know, in the wall, and people are convinced there's a ghost pounding on the wall, and, you know, clearly you don't want to tell them it sounds like there's a rat running down the pipe on the inside
yeah.
of the hall, you know.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where, you know, it's best to narrow to get rid of everything else first before you jump to conclusions. You know, my approach has always been with my books is that I don't try to prove or disprove, because honestly, I don't think it's the way society is now. You can never scientifically, I take it back, you can never prove to anyone's satisfaction that ghosts were real if they don't want to believe. And somebody that wants to believe, you're never going to convince them. You're never going to absolutely, convince them otherwise.
Right.
So it's one of those things where you're going to believe or you don't. Sometimes things happen to you and you believe, and sometimes, you just don't. But, so what I try to do is look at the legend in context, see, what we can learn from it. Maybe that'll help us one way or another when we approach them.
Yeah, exactly. Henry, you still alive?
No,
And we have proof of a ghost.
Oh, that was the best EVP ever.
Oh, yeah.
Direct voice phenomena.
Which I think it's the thrill when you have these legends and stuff. I guess older people does it too, but a lot of the younger people from the legends, they want to go out to these places just to see if they can see something or hear something or whatever the legend might be. And I think it's the thrill of going out doing stuff like that. That's what keeps a legend alive.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what, folklore, most people now know the term too, the legend trip, where, you go out and you purposely set out to a place that's supposed to be haunted to try to provoke a supernatural response somehow. And sometimes that's something simple. There's usually some ritual involved. Often it's, something like, you hear the stories like going to the, a tunnel and blowing your horn 3 times or calling somebody's name or going to a place at a certain time. You hope to provoke a supernatural response. Of course, you're testing all kinds of boundaries. You're probably not supposed to be there. It's fun. There's the thrill of interacting with the supernatural. And ultimately, if you do get a response, and if you believe it, then you also just prove there's life after death, too, at least, in some way.
Right.
At least you believe, if you might believe that. If you're, but, at many levels, and this is probably a statement that will get me in trouble, it has before, but on some levels, ghost hunting is a legend trip.
Oh, of course.
You take equipment. You take equipment. It's just, you're not using, for teenagers, it usually revolves around your car. You go there, you do something with your car, you get out of your car and walk into the woods, do something. And you usually do something simple like blow a horn 3 times or do something else to provoke the response. But, now it's like you go with a voice recorder or any of the, an EMF detector, and you do something, ask it to respond, and make the light up, and that's your response. But essentially, you're just doing the same steps with technology.
Oh, yeah.
Or a different type of technology. I mean, you use your car, that's technology, too.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the irony of the whole thing, because you're talking about ghosts, the furthest thing from technology. We use that as the tool to interact.
Right. I've heard other paranormal enthusiasts call it basically paranormal Disneyland, going to a lot of these haunted locations just to do these open hunts. And then I think that's true, because people get a thrill just like riding a roller coaster. So
it is fun to go down a dark road, that's supposed to have something weird happen that, I always figure as long as nobody's causing any damage or hurting anybody, it's not not a problem.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Well, now you went down this one road called Blue Mist Road, and what's that supposed to have? Just a mist that rolls in or something, or was it there when you went?
Oh yeah, definitely. I've probably been on that road close to 100 times. I've walked it completely. It's about 3 miles, dark, isolated road. It's one of my favorite haunted roads and one of my favorite allegedly haunted places. And actually, if you indulge me for a second, I'll tell the story of it. Its real name is Irwin Road, and it's situated near North Park in Allegheny County, north of Pittsburgh. And the road's been closed for many years. Now, the far end, it connects two other roads, Babcock Boulevard, Route 910, but it's been closed for many years. It goes for about 3 miles. And across from the far end, the north end of the road, is a cemetery. And at the other end, you know, there's one house on that road that sits up off the road that the front of the first maybe half mile of the road is still paved and maintained, but it's authorized vehicles only. And then the whole middle section of the road, like probably the middle mile of the road, is blocked off by metal barriers and basically it's just decayed. It's crumbling away. So that's owned by a group called the Allegheny Land Trust, which has preserved it as a walking trail now, right next to North Park. And then the last maybe half mile of the road or whatever, three quarters of a mile, is just a regular neighborhood now. But that's not the part where people go, they think it's haunted. It's the main abandoned stretch. And there's been many legends over the years. I like this one because it shows the changes over time. The original story was there was a car accident there where a family was killed either by a drunk driver or a deer that ran out. Their car went off the road, wrecked. And they died. And of course, once the, if you could drive back there when the road was open before they closed it in the 70s or so, if you could get your car back there to that spot and put it in neutral, of course, it would push you back up the road. Around that same time, there was another legend associated with the cemetery, and there's two tombstones that lean toward each other. And the legend always was that if you went there under full moon, the tombstones would touch. Now, those are basically, harmless legends. But by the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, the legends changed a little bit, and there was a new layer of legends added. And this time, it was the Ku Klux Klan that supposedly was using the roads to have meetings and, of course, to lynch people. And supposedly, they killed several people on the road whose ghosts now walk the road. And they did it, supposedly, under this specific tree called the Hanging Tree, where, you know, you would often find the victim or the victim's ghost. And, of course, if the Klan found you there, you might do the next victim. And there's some stories of, like, you know, kind of classic urban legend stories where a car dying underneath there and the husband gets out to go get help. The wife hears a scraping on the hood, and then she gets out of the car and her husband's hanging from the tree. But, and so you could identify the hanging tree because it bled when the moon was full, according to the legend. So a couple years after that, that ghost circulates for a while. But right around 1981, and throughout the 80s, there's a new legend that gets associated with that, and that's satanic cults using the road for ceremonies, sacrifices, and they supposedly even summoned the devil himself, who walked around with bipedal hoof prints on the road. And there was an old structure off the road that they called the cult house or the witch house, which had collapsed, but that's where the ceremonies were supposed to take place. It was way up in the woods in an old dirt-covered driveway that was now, by looked more like a path than a driveway. And then by the mid-90s, that continued all the way prior to the early 90s. And then by the mid-90s again, there was the legend about the tombstones changed, and now they didn't touch under a full moon. People that heard it in the mid-90s said that they were slowly getting closer and closer together, and finally when they touched, the world would end. And then after the year 2000, it went back to just people searching, especially like since 2005 or so, just everybody going there searching for the ghosts of any of the previously mentioned disasters, or people. Now, if you could backtrack, now one thing we found was there was a real car accident that may have inspired that original story. And a whole family wasn't killed, but a woman was killed. Her young children were in back, but they survived. She was killed right at the front of that road where Irwin meets Babcock Boulevard. So that we think that inspired the legend. However, about the car moving uphill against, being pushed up by the ghost, there's actually a gravity hill in North Park not far from there. You could walk to it from there. And what we think happened is that, people knew about the gravity hill at that time, too. And, it's an optical illusion in this case where it looks like your car rolls uphill. Mm-hmm. Somehow, in multiple retellings, the two stories combined, so the ghosts were pushing this car uphill on Bloomis Road instead of up on Gravity Hill. The Klan stuff in the 70s popped up, and then people think, well, that's kind of a weird time, mid to late 70s for the Klan. And, in the stories, they're always, they're often killing, like, white teenagers in the story, not what you would think. But there's a couple of theories on that. But in many ways, that may have been, people think, the bulk of the civil rights movement and racial tension stuff, people often think, wrapped up in the 60s or early 70s, with kind of the race riots and everything. But there was still a lot of tension that lingered into the early to mid-70s. And in, a region like this, it wasn't as much over, direct conflicts per se as things like, busing issues, swimming pools that still didn't allow African Americans, things like mm-hmm. that. So there was a lot of subtle racial tension. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing I found is, like, throughout, like, Western PA and parts of Ohio and New York and West Virginia, around that time, around the mid to late 70s, there was probably two or three dozen places that suddenly had Ku Klux Klan legends simultaneously, which is, you know, I thought was an interesting trend. They all suddenly popped up at the same time. You know, all the same thing. They all have a hanging tree, you know, all the same kind of MO, you know, where they're going after people. So, you know, that clearly emerged in multiple places at that time. In the 1980s, you know, we mentioned the satanic panic already when people thought Satanists were running around everywhere. Geraldo went on TV, said there were, you know, something like 6 or 9 million active Satanists abducting 900,000 children every year, ooh, which he, of course, he later retracted and said, you know, he was completely wrong.
Oh, no.
But there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff that happened with that. You know, Procter & Gamble had to change its logo because someone claimed they were Satanists. The McMartin preschool case, the famous case, where they accused preschool teachers of being Satanists using kind of shoddy methods, and that became the most expensive trial in U.S. history, and of course they were all found innocent. But, you know, that left an impact on local folklore, and certainly you had, you know, people, adults took it seriously. Psychologists and certain law enforcement people took it seriously. And so, of course, teenagers will then take it seriously, especially if they're, I remember somebody warning me when I was in the 1980s, not to go out to that road because some kid from another school district was kidnapped by a cult out there. Of course, that never happened.
Right.
But, you know, but you hear this when you're young, you start to take these things seriously. So I know lots of people who thought there really was a cult out there, or at least sometimes they were out there. And so, you know, that leaves that impact. Of course, the tombstones by the mid-1990s, you know, having the, you know, as we approach the year 2000, the end of the world thing with that is clear of the connotation. And of course, now everybody is looking for the the ghosts of any of it. That's what, you know, we all know ghost hunting is very popular now. So people go out there with their equipment and go looking for the ghosts of any of the previously mentioned things. Now, you know, the only thing that's definitely true there is the car accident. But, you know, people claim, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, I'm certain, you know, amateur occultists might have heard about the satanic cult, went out there and tried something. Certainly people have graffiti everywhere, but most of it's probably teenagers joking around. But things, even like the hoof prints I mentioned, bipedal hoof prints, you do find what look like bipedal hoof prints on that road. But part of the reason is because the road's like half dirt, half crumbling asphalt. So anything with four legs that would walk on there would probably only leave two prints every time it took a step, because part of it would be on concrete, part would be in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there's like practical explanations for it, but I mean, I have hundreds of accounts of people going out there and having something happen, you know,
right,
or claiming they encounter a ghost. And I'll be honest, I take my folklore class out that I teach at La Roche out there, and every time I take them out, something weird happens.
Oh, really?
But I mean, yeah, but theoretically, there's nothing, you know,
yeah,
it's all urban legend except the car accident, technically, but it still feels weird out there.
Yeah. Right.
So it's one of those things where, you think it's fine, but you're never quite entirely
sure.
Well,
you fall back into the scientists observing the experiment becomes part of the experiment, and you're going to have those experiences because they're expected, if not created.
And And I was wondering just how much of a funhouse effect happens on an uneven road like that, just to add to the ambiance.
That's exactly it too.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's near a park, so you hear animals in the woods, you know.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of, you know, every once in a while you see eyes, if you have a flashlight or shine on a set of eyes, you know, that are out there.
Right.
Occasionally you see a coyote off in the woods and somebody thinks it's a wolf, you know.
Oh.
Something like that. So it's, you know, it definitely, you know, it definitely has that effect. And that's why it's, in some ways it's fun to go there, you know, but that's an example of one that most of it really isn't true. But, you know, sometimes other haunted roads are tied to real events. I mean, I've researched somewhere, you know, in the past there was a real murder tied to the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often it's not explicitly mentioned in the legend, but you can see where it would inspire the legend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're really, you know, looking for ghosts, that maybe that's where your connection is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's interesting. And I like to look at these, like, as I said, on a variety of levels, not try to say is it haunted or not, you know.
Right.
But what else is going on here? And often if I ever go with a group of people, I often spend as much time watching people as I do watching the road or the place I'm going.
Right.
Because I think sometimes that's, you learn more that way sometimes.
Yes, definitely. Well,
go ahead.
Break time.
Yep.
This is a very good natural pause. And let everyone think about the Blue Mist Road story. And we have plenty of other stories coming up.
So, Kat will be taking us out the break.
Yes.
And
yes.
We will let Barbara bring us back. So, be about 5-6 minutes, something like that. So, why don't everybody sit back and relax? And, Kat, you can take us out. How's that sound?
Sounds like a plan. So, everyone, you are listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Kat Kloko. Tonight, we are joined by prolific paranormal author Thomas White and his new book he co-authored with Tony LaVorna, Haunted Roads of Western Pennsylvania, in the Haunted America series by Arcadia Publishing. You can find it on Amazon.com for the Kindle or paperback. There are more spooks to come after the break.
Don't go away. The Paranormal View will be right back.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You'll be guided through the Golden Age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
So, you had a lucid dream about living in Atlantis, teaching telepathy, and you're wondering what it means. We can actually help. We are the School of Metaphysics, a 40-year-old international resource for people who have questions, big, juicy, deep questions about life and death and everything in between. 16 branches in the U.S., self-guided study online, weekend courses, webinars, and books. Send us a telepathic fax or visit our website, www.som.org. This could be the start of something really interesting.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
Ghost Hunters Case Log 451. The time? Thursday, 8 p.m. Okay, we're going to start an EVP session. Is there anyone out there? Can you repeat that? I really need you to try to project louder and slower so we can all hear.
The Black Cat Lounge.
That's right, gang. Listen in, the Black Cat Lounge, every Thursday night, 8 o'clock, on Para X.
You know, there's nothing like a great memory of a great time. And if you grew up during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, boy, have we got the memories for you. There was no time more innocent than the 1950s or 60s, nor was there a time more politically explosive. Hi, this is Steve Shockley, a.k.a. The Shock. Join me live every Friday and Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern for a Baby Boomer Rock with a Shock Sock Hop on Rock with a Shock Radio.com.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio and the all-new Para-X Vision can help. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio and Para-X Vision, programming for the open mind.
Para-X Radio presents Real Persons of Genius.
Real Persons of Genius.
Today, we salute you, Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Armed with nothing more than a laptop and a microphone, you hit the air to scare the bejesus out of your audience.
What the hell was that noise?
Like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant, you always whet our appetite for more.
I just can't get enough.
Whether it's witches, ghosts, fairies, or Bigfoot, we admire your ability to set aside reality and believe anything anyone tells you.
Seek professional help.
So the next time you're kneeling in front of your 8x10 glossy of Dave and Tom lighting a candle, remember, if it wasn't for you, I might be able to sleep without the lights on.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X Soho.
Para-X Radio Network, powered by CBS.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio. We want to thank you all for joining us this evening, especially for those in the chat room and listening all around the world. And tonight we have listeners in the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, France, and Germany. Welcome, welcome, everybody, with our very special guest, author Thomas White. Thank you. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, we lost you.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Now, I'm curious, because we're talking about legend tripping and on these roads, and I'm wondering, I know of some groups that actually are trying to document ghost sightings along highways, etc. If there's a consistency to a lot of these stories that would be interpreted as an active hunt, mm-hmm. whether or not you've had any ideas or urge to go back and actually document to see if you actually see a ghost sighting.
Well, I will say, you know, if there's a place that has things happen over and over again that are consistent, and you know, you definitely should attempt to, you know, make attempts to document them. A lot of the work, this latest book was one of all the books I've done, this is the one that has the most urban legends that turned out not to be true in it, or at least probably not true, but they're interesting, you know, and they're things that people should keep in mind. But certainly there's places that do have, you know, there's real crimes, real murders behind it. And one of the things I always, you know, as a professional historian, is I really try to document what's going on. Because, you know, one good example is there's this famous road in Western PA called 13 Bends Road, and I'm sorry, and it, you go up you know, you go up 13 bends, but when you come back down, there's only 12. But when you get up there, of course, well, a couple things happen. A car follows you up, but then it disappears off a bend. It's supposed to be a couple that was killed in a car accident. When you get to either the top or the bottom, depending on which version you hear, there was supposed to be an orphanage that burned down. And, of course, all the children inside died, and they would come out, and they would, if you parked your car, they would leave handprints on your car. And you might hear them crying in the woods or actually playing in the woods. You know, you'd hear them nearby. You'd hear them walking around your car. And that was the story. And so there's actually multiple roads that claim to be this road, but the one that seems to be the oldest legend, about 40 or 50 years old, we checked out. And sure enough, on the map, we got an old Sanborn insurance map out from the 1930s. And sure enough, there's an orphanage at the bottom of the road. Then, you know, we started investigating whether there was a fire. And the orphanage was right next to this old church called St. Peter's. It was an old Catholic church. And as we were investigating, we discovered, you know what, there really was a fire, 1924, New Year's Day. However, it was at the church right next door. The orphanage never burned down. In fact, it just stopped being used. But there was this real community memory that survived in the legend of something burning there. And the orphanage was just torn down a decade later. But that idea that there was something down there, you know. Now, whether they really encountered anybody, I mean, who's to say when you have these encounters? You know, but there's certainly, you know, when you look at the historical record, you sometimes can find, you know, these verifications. Or, you have to go beyond just the legends that you're told, or even people that live in an area and they say, oh, yeah, that used to be, you know, this or that up there. Sometimes you have to check that out because memories can be wrong. Things can be off. But, you know, as I said before, a lot of the stories in this book, you know, there some of them had real truth to them. Other ones were kind of urban legends, or there were certainly many of them had some historical basis there behind them. You know, other places I've been to and written about in some of my other books were definitely more more directly haunted, I think, you know, if I want to put it in those terms. You know, there was things that were a lot weirder even on these roads. You know, that happened. But the roads, I think, they're certainly a kind of, they're the most democratic of the legend trip places. You don't get in trouble if you're on a road. It's public property. So they get the most stories about them. And that's why we've focused on the roads for this book.
Now, in your book, Supernatural Lore of Pennsylvania, yes. You had some interesting stories in that book also. You had one called The Pig Lady of Cannelton, is that right?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the best ghost stories I've ever uncovered. It's one of the ones that probably, you know, if I thought, you know, of ones that I thought might be true, I think that is certainly one of them. And The Pig Lady is based, it's a 200-year-old ghost story from Northern Beaver County, and Cannelton Road is all that's left of this little town that was there, you know, in the 1800s called Cannelton, and it was a little mining/farming town. And there's this family that was out there called the McCaskies, and they actually had come up as kind of refugees after the American Revolution. They got land on the frontier in what was called the depreciation land. That's when they gave soldiers land because their Continental money was worthless. So they took their Continental money to buy land certificates and got land on the frontier. Ironically, it was Benjamin Franklin's idea. He also wanted to use them as a shield on the Indian frontier because they were experienced soldiers. But, of course, he didn't tell them that. But so they moved out to the frontier, and Samuel McCaskey had a daughter named Barbara who actually married a Revolutionary War veteran when she was 13. By the time she was 15 or 16, she was either dead or gone. She came back to live with the family, but her last name was now Davidson. And one day in 1795, the rest of the family left Barbara in charge of the farm to go to Pittsburgh, which, you know, today would be from this place a 45-minute drive at most. Back then it would have been, you know, an overnight trip. They were going to Pittsburgh to get more livestock from one of the markets. And, you know, Barbara was well-liked in the community. She had many male suitors. There were many people that really loved her. But she was very responsible when she was, you know, 17 years old at the time. And she was left in charge of the farm. She was always in charge of taking care of the pigs and the swine and the livestock. So she was left in charge. The family's gone for 2 days or so. They come back, and they can't find her anywhere.
you know, it wasn't like her to run off or shirk her responsibility. So they checked with some of the neighboring farms, and sure enough, you know, no one can find her. So everyone's really panicked because everyone really likes Barbara, and they look around for several days. And just as the family's getting really frustrated, they notice there's this really strong smell coming from somewhere in the house. And then they realize it's coming from underneath, it's coming up through the floor. And they go outside and they look under the house, and they realize Barbara's body's been wedged under the house, and its head was gone. And they never found her killer, and they never found her head. And that, I mean, that's a real murder, that really happened.
Wow.
Yeah, and some people speculated that there was, across from their farm property up on the hill, there was an orchard, and then there were a couple mines, and some people think somebody took her head through the mine shaft. Mm. Well, she was buried about half a mile away in the cemetery. And the weird thing about this case is, like, there's basically like a square mile that this ghost appears in. It's a very big, like, her family's whole property, and a lot of it's still there. In fact, the old road that they used to use is like a trail back by the Little Beaver River. There's a bridge back there. And ever since that time, people have seen her ghost. And, like, it materializes out of smoke in the field or mist, and it doesn't have a head. And, you know, when I first heard this, I thought, this is too good to be true, a headless ghost, you know, and people see it, and lots of people see it. And sure enough, I mean, I talked to a lot of people, and there were important people in that area that didn't want to be identified. But they were serious. They weren't, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm pretty good at that spot, and people are making things up, and not a single person here was making anything up. And I'll tell you why in a minute, some of the other details, but this is the most witnesses I've ever encountered for anything over the years. And there's all these stories, there's famous stories. In fact, there's a guy that came down the hill from that orchard on a cart back in the 1840s. He was coming down with his horse one night, the cart full of apples. This ball of light shot out of the mine and seemed to attach itself to his horse. And his horse went charging down the hill. And he's trying to gain control, and the apples are all bouncing out of the cart. And he's bouncing down this narrow, you know, dirt road. He thinks there's something like hanging off the back of the head. He realizes there's this ball of light, and he realizes it looks like a head or hair. And suddenly the face turns around. It's like a decaying woman's face.
Oof.
And it turns back around, drives the horse all the way down the hill, across the farm, all the way into the Little Beaver River, the North Fork of the Little Beaver River. And that's when the horse finally stops. In the 1930s, you know, the ghost was so well known that a trolley company started, you know, like in the early years of the Depression, trying to make money. They thought to take people out and tell them the story, like an early haunted tour.
Right.
Well, the first night they take people out there, the guy's telling the story, then suddenly he stops in the middle of telling the story. Everyone, the trolley turns and looks, and out in the field, in front of their eyes, this mist starts to take the shape of the woman without a head. And she walks around for like 15 minutes in front of them, and then slowly disappears into the smoke and vanishes. And this ended up in the newspaper the next day. You know, at first people thought it was a trolley.
Let me look and see. We may have lost him.
Did he get abducted?
I don't know, but it doesn't show that he... It shows he's still on.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
Yeah. Thomas!
Come back to us, Thomas. I want to hear more about this headless ghost.
I hope his phone didn't go dead.
It's suspense.
Oh, gosh. Was he calling via cell phone?
I don't know if he was on a cell phone or if he's on a landline.
Call him back.
But apparently it's not there.
Well, hang up and try calling him again.
Yeah. Let me see here what's going on.
No news.
Yeah, it doesn't say. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hang it up and then dial him again, see if I can get him back in.
Okay.
This reminds me a lot of the story, the headless story, Bobby Mackey's.
Yeah, it does, with Pearl.
Being beheaded and her head thrown down a well. This guy, you know, is beheaded and...
Yeah, still not found. The head's still not found. I bet you an animal took off with it. Yeah. So for our listeners, while Henry tries to call back Thomas. We're talking about Thomas White's book, Haunted Roads of Western Pennsylvania, which is in the Haunted America series published by Arcadia Publishing. It just came out September 28th of this year, so it's a brand spanking new book. It's a baby book. Just as in, it's really new. And, yeah, it's a good read. I've been reading it. It has a lot of folklore stuff in it, which I always like. It's very thoughtful.
And it's nice to see a good academic book come out of this.
Yes, it is. They come out once in a while when the academics have enough time to write them. But, yeah, it's a good book. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Research is extremely tedious, folks. Extremely tedious.
Yeah.
I give a lot of kudos to academics who do a lot of background, which he seems to have done.
What?
Oh, there he is.
Hi. There. That's weird. I think maybe Ghost disconnected and signed out.
I did. Just all of a sudden, it was gone, and I couldn't get it all back.
Yeah.
It was weird. My son just blinked out. I'm not sure what the last part you heard. Did you hear me mention the school superintendent out there who was collecting? He's kind of a local historian. He collected all these legends about this pig lady. And so what he did was he actually made them into a play they put on in the school district out there every other year, where they tell the history of the community through the ghost story. But a couple of years ago, this pig lady story inspired them to, the local Lions Club out there was going to make a haunted house, like to raise money. And so they thought, there's an old barn on the old McCaskey family property. So they thought, let's make a haunted house, like a haunted attraction barn on the property. Then when people go through that, we'll take them on a hayride and tell them the real ghost story down to all the places where the ghost has been seen. That kind of sounds like the start of a horror movie. but what they did then, so what they did then was they, you know, what can go wrong? Well, obviously, like almost immediately, people that are working out there start seeing things, and a whole bunch of them. If there were some kids that quit because they kept seeing things, one of the people, and there were dozens of reports of strange things happening, people seeing the headless ghost, you know, things, weird things happening up near the gravesite. One of the people that had the most, you know, strange encounters was the young woman that was playing Barbara Davidson, who actually saw like a headless figure in the barn. And then another time she was walking across the field and people could see her crossing the field. And suddenly she got knocked down crossing the field and blacked out. Nobody was immediately around her, so they were going to help her. And then all of a sudden she stands up a few minutes later and she's way far away from where she fell down.
Huh.
And, you know, it was only a matter of seconds and nobody could figure out how she moved that far across the field. And suddenly she was up, and, you know, she really thought that she had seen lots of, you know, convincing things. But the best part of the story, and I have more in that book, more of the details, but the best part of the story is one night when the guy was sitting down by it, they had a fire pit. They had a little fire down by the river on the road that goes down to the river where they were, you know, they were supposed to bring the wagon down with the people to tell the story. And the guy that was sitting down there was supposed to tell the story of the murder. And he's sitting down there one night, and out of the smoke forms the shape of the headless ghost out of the campfire smoke. And he, you know, he calls the guys up at the thing, says, I think she's here. And they make fun of him, of course. And then he says, no, just get down here. So they leave to come down. But meantime, he sees this thing form, and then it talked to him. And what it said was, it actually spoke to him.
Wow.
And it said, tell them Renault. He's like, he's thinking, what's Renault? And it says, tell them Renault. And it disappeared again. And so those guys came down, you know, it was gone. And he started to tell them the story, and they were laughing at him. And it starts to form again. And they all ran away, and then it disappeared. the guy that heard this told Rich Oswald, the guy that was doing all the research over the years. And Rich started doing more research, and he's like, what's Renault? And he realized, that sounds like a French last name. Mm-hmm. And so, strangely enough, and this is one of the weirdest parts, you know, the death of the chill up your spine, he found an account of a half-French, half-Indian trapper whose last name was Renault, who was in Carrollton at the time of the murder. He left shortly after. And apparently, I guess back then, some people thought he might have been guilty, but it never really, you know, it didn't really circulate well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people think that was the ghost naming her killer. And that was just like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago that happened.
Oh, wow. For
only like a year or so before I wrote that in the book. And so that was, I thought that was one of the most interesting stories. But when I tell you, I mean, there's literally, I've never seen a story where there's been that many people.
Right.
Now, nobody wants to use their name, though, because they're all afraid they're going to be, you know, made fun of or something. But there were a lot of people that had firsthand experiences.
So did you
ever? It was an interesting story. Yes, I did.
Did you see anything or feel anything when you was there?
It felt unusual, but I didn't see anything. Now, I was there at daytime, but, of course, she supposedly appears during the day, too. I mean, you know. And the place is haunted. It's haunted 24 hours a day.
True.
But it was. I guess it was early evening, but it was in the summer, so it was light. You know, it was like 7 or 8 o'clock in the summer.
Now.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead and finish.
Oh no, I was just going to say it was. You know, it's one of those places that definitely felt unusual. Of all the places I've been, I've probably been to, you know, several hundred of these places at least, and. It was one of the ones that definitely felt weird. Maybe, you know, of all the places I've gone, maybe about 30 or 40 of them have actually felt weird, you know, felt like there's something going on. Some, maybe there's a handful, maybe five that really felt, you know, like there was definitely something there. And this was one of the ones that definitely felt like there was something to it. I couldn't tell you what, but there was that feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had another story in the book. And it's more like a spooky story, I would say, that you sit around telling everybody at night in the dark or something. It was called There's Something Out There in the Dark.
Let's see. Yeah, which...
which book is that from, Henry?
Yeah.
That was in the Supernatural Lore of Pennsylvania.
Oh yeah, see, I'm trying to think which one that was something out there. Oh yeah, that's in the chapter. Yeah, it's in the chapter on monsters. Yeah, that's kind of the introduction to that. We did put the subtitle of that book is Ghost Monsters and Miracles, and that has some other stories, and that's kind of the introduction to the monster section. But you know, one of the things I talked about in that section is the Pennsylvania werewolf stories.
Right. Yeah.
In Pennsylvania, you know, and one of my books was on witchcraft in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of it focused on the Pennsylvania Dutch tradition, Pennsylvania German, you know, and, excuse me, but the, along with that came a lot of werewolf stories that I was surprised. I kept finding them. I thought I'd find two or three. It was a really long tradition of werewolf stories tied to the Pennsylvania Germans. And, you know, tied to the tradition of folk magic and folk healing in Pennsylvania. It all kind of overlaps. And, you know, if you look at traditional European folklore, witchcraft and werewolves weren't separated like we put in our head in, you know, in movies today. You know, we have a clear line of distinction between the two. And, you know, medieval Europe, you know, early modern Europe, excuse me, there wasn't that distinction. You know, I found many stories where witches turned into wolves. And other stories are called werewolf stories where the werewolf doesn't kill anything. It just harasses people's livestock like a witch would. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the direct attack, but kind of the harassment. And these stories are very interesting because they, you know, they fit directly. I mean, they are like true transplants from European lore that have come over. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my favorite stories is the story of Peter Pence, that Peter Pence told about his... he told around 1900, he told a story to a famous folklorist in the state, Henry Shoemaker. He's actually the first state folklorist. And he was the first state folklorist anywhere. Pennsylvania had first state folklorist. He collected this story. Peter Pence was an old hunter, and he heard this story. He was an old man when he told it, but it happened to his aunt in the 1850s or so, 1860s maybe. Mm-hmm. And that was a case of, she was a midwife. And so she had just gotten done delivering twins, which was, of course, a difficult process at that time period. And she was walking home late one night. It was at a neighboring farm. She was walking home. And she looked up kind of in the moonlight and on the horizon. She was almost to her gate, and she saw this four-legged thing. And she thought it looked like a big black dog at first walking. It started to move closer and closer to her as she walked. And then suddenly she realized it started to kind of get up on its back legs. And so she ran as fast as she could, and it started closing the distance between the two of them chasing her. And she ran up in the dark, you know, mind you, it's like 2 in the morning. I was pounding on her front door, gets it open. Her husband wakes up, comes to the door. She slams it shut. She tells him the story quickly. And so, you know, you think the first thing would be to question somebody. But, you know, in these traditional kind of German communities, that wasn't the case. He believed her. He got his gun. He went to the mantle where they kept special bullets wrapped in blessed wax. Basically, they were probably given to him by a powwow, or probably a Pennsylvania Dutch folk healer. Mm-hmm. And so he loads the gun with a bullet, steps out on his porch, sees the thing out there in the yard, just as she described, inside the fence now, and he fires, and he hits it, and it drops. Mm-hmm. He reloads the gun with another shot, and he very cautiously walks over, and by the time he gets over there, it's turned into his neighbor. And, you know, his neighbor's dying and thanks him for releasing him from the curse. Now, it sounds like almost like a movie story, you know.
Right.
But this was written down in 1900 before any of those movies took place. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting tale. That's one of the more dramatic ones. There's quite a few stories where, like, you know, the werewolves were breaking into, like barns and stables and harassing animals, and they'd shoot and wound one of them. And the next day, a woman from the neighborhood would come around that she'd have a broken leg or a broken, or wherever they shot the wolf would be injured on her, asking for help. Some of those stories were tied in proximity to these various mountains that were associated with witchcraft in Pennsylvania. It's interesting these how these stories have survived. You don't think, I mean, there's lots of current, like, modern dogman sightings and all, you know, the whole variety of things that go on, but there's really this really long tradition up here.
Wow. Yeah, werewolf stories are always super interesting to me. It's just, especially the older ones, like pre-Hollywood. No, go ahead.
They're tied to the witchcraft, and I think that, you know, they're often tied with that. And, you know, before Hollywood got its hands on it, you could see the real kind of context in which these things emerged.
Yeah.
It wasn't as much about a strange animal as it was about this kind of magical, evil, magical force that was coming after.
Well, if memory serves me right, didn't the Bell Witch also show up as a black dog at one point?
I believe so. You know, lots of times the black dogs will show up. I've probably dozens and dozens of stories where black dogs show up either in graveyards or, you know, they're any place where a witch supposedly was.
Yeah.
You know, dogs, cats, whatever, you know, they just show up either way. There's a great story about a witch that was in this mill in central PA where it was actually the mill owner's wife, it turned out, was the witch. And what happened is this black cat would come in and harass whoever was working in the mill. And the one night this guy stayed up with an axe, and when the cat came near his bed and started getting really large, like it was going to scratch him, he cut off part of its paw, and it ran away. And he had suspected the mill owner's wife, and so the next day he barged into their house and demanded to see her, and sure enough, her hand was bandaged. And, she was the witch that was harassing him in the mill, but she turned into this big black cat.
I'm just amused because I own a black dog and black cats live on my porch, so I apparently fit the description.
I think what we're going to do is go ahead and take our last break, and I'll let Kat take us out and Barbara will bring us back. I just want to remind everyone, if you do have questions for Thomas, you can send a private chat or private message to either Ceiling Cat, Cat, or myself, and we will get those questions right over. Also, if you're listening from somewhere else other in the chat room, you can send us an email to theparanormalview@gmail.com with your question. And it is answered right away.
And you can also tweet them over to @ParaviewRadio on Twitter. So with that, everyone, you are listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, myself, Cac Logo. Tonight we are joined by paranormal author Thomas White, and we have more spooks to come after the break.
Attention, attention, humans of Earth. This is a message from Scaro. You are tuned to para-x.com for The Paranormal View. Random sounds you call music is about to be generated for a period of approximately 500 rels, after which The Paranormal View will resume. You are to stay tuned to prevent your being exterminated. Transmission ends.
I found it at last! Marla's Sacred Cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron!
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going!
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream in Gettysburg. You're listening to The Paranormal View on Para-X Radio Network.
Good news, everyone!
We're back, baby!
That's right, we're back! Hi, I'm Pat McCormick, and Ghost Soldiers Radio is back! We're teaming up with The Shock on Rock with The Shock Radio, and we are on a mission.
We're on a mission from God.
A mission to play great music and have fun.
God be praised.
Ghost Soldiers Radio starts May 16th at 10 p.m. on rockwiththeshock.com.
Hey, kid, you like music?
Sure.
Good.
So if you like music, join us as we move on up. Saturday, May 16th at 10 p.m.
Well, we're moving on up.
So join us May 16th at 10 p.m. for Ghost Soldiers Radio, only on rockwiththeshock.com.
We finally got a piece of the pie.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, and all kind of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear...
Line.
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's The Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Cat Cloco, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They all talk gobbledygooky, the Para-X family. The shows are paranormal, not stuffy but informal. The topics are abnormal, the Para-X family.
They're strange, deranged, unrestrained.
So grab your favorite brew, it's time to rendezvous, as we give awards to the Para-X family.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio with our very special guest, Thomas White, author of Haunted Roads of Western Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Thomas.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a wonderful and very intriguing discussion. it's curious because I'm wondering how much of folklore is regional and the type of folklore is regional. Like, we've been talking about the haunted roads, but if you look at fairy tales, they have a tendency, bad things happen in the woods. You know, Hansel and Gretel go into the woods, they get eaten by a witch. The Little Red Riding Hood goes to the woods to visit her aunt or her grandmother and the wolf. Is it that we're trying to develop our own fairy tales, in a sense, with these myths or urban legends? About, you know, don't go into the woods because the boogeyman will get you?
I think it's definitely an extension of that. You know, we're not afraid of the woods like we used to be. You know, the woods actually, you know, the classic fairy tales were written, mm-hmm. the woods really were a dangerous mm-hmm. place, you know, and I mean, they still are, obviously, you know, but we're not, again, like, you know, the woods around that most of us experience aren't, you know, the kind of wild forest that, you know, that they wrote about in the past. But, you know, there's definitely these places. That's why you also see, you know, certainly these, like I said earlier, like, you know, the idea of it being a liminal space, these kind of abandoned places of transition where they're not used anymore. They're on the fringes of, you know, wherever people usually live, and or they're just nestled in these kind of isolated corners where, you know, often you feel like you're not supposed to be there. And, you know, that's why there's lots of ghost stories in things that are ruined, mm-hmm. you know, ruins in general, and you know, whether industrial or old, you know, ancient ruins or whatever they are.
Is it that we're...
And there's definitely something about those...
Is it that we're trying to replace ogres and trolls with a new kind of monster?
Yeah, I think, you know, the monsters always change over time. You know, if you look at monsters in the Middle Ages, for example, like back to werewolves, or anything in the Middle Ages, you know, a monster in the Middle Ages was something that was, you know, something was kind of an affront to God, essentially. You know, if you look at kind of the medieval worldview, there are things that were like half man, half beast, these strange things that were kind of corruptions of what God created. You know, at other times in history, the monsters reflect what people are afraid of. You know, you could say with UFOs, right? Since UFOs, the real UFO phenomenon, as far as like kind of as a mass sure. phenomenon, you know, if you don't look at some of the weird sightings before, emerge after World War II, you know, in the birth of the nuclear age and, you know, jets and aircraft, really, there were more up in the sky than ever before. You know, it's a threat of destruction from above from the Soviets with nuclear missiles. And certainly then kind of the boogeyman came from above, from like out there, and he was, you know, he didn't attack you with claws or fangs, or he didn't possess you. He obliterated you with technology. You know, and at one level, we're afraid of that today. And even if you look at things like Frankenstein, the reason like the Frankenstein legend is endured, the story of Frankenstein, is because it's a warning about tampering with nature, but also tampering with technology. You know, and it's a double-edged sword, and that we should be a little bit afraid when we do any of these things. And so, yeah, the monsters definitely adapt to wherever you are or whatever the situation is. You know, on some level, you know, I think we, you know, you kind of need monsters, at least in the imagination. Not in real life, of course, you know, but there's enough people that are monsters already. But, you know, certainly the imagination needs monsters as a way to kind of put a face, I think, on fear, you know, or fears. And all these things, I mean, all of it in some way is a way to address fear. You know, you go down a haunted road, you go searching for a monster in the woods, you know, whatever you do. You know, at some level you're addressing fears among many other things. I think that's the thing about all these stories, that they're very complicated. There's always more than one thing going on at one time. You know, I mean, a place could be haunted, it may not be. You know, if it's really haunted, then it's really haunted. That doesn't mean there's not also all these different layers of things also happening at the same time. And that's why these things are fascinating, because they're much more complex. I mean, you can take the kind of surface story of any ghost story as it is, but if you take that and you take every little piece and layer that goes into it, you find it infinitely more complicated. And it shows you all different types of things about human nature, about, you know, why we're looking for these things and why people in the past looked for them as opposed to why we do now. And it makes it even that much more interesting. And maybe it's really haunted.
That's
to,
true.
You know.
Is it kind of a teenage rite of passage now, where before they would go out into the woods, kill a bear or whatever? They don't do that anymore, but there's that lack of that passage, it seems, to adulthood.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what it is, because first of all, you know, it's something they can do that, you know, we've, in some level, we've coddled everyone, where, like, you know, in the past, you know, like a young Indian might be sent off to hunt and kill something that could potentially kill him too, you know. And there's we've kind of taken the danger out of growing up on some level, you know. I mean, not entirely, obviously, but you know what I'm trying to say. And, you know, so there's this kind of artificial danger that we use, and we're going down these haunted roads and these supernatural legends, which nobody can protect you from if it's real. You know, who's going to come save you from the supernatural force if it's really going to come after you? Of course, you know, it's ultimately usually quite safe, you know, going down to a haunted road or a haunted tunnel and, you know, performing one of these legend trips. But it is, you know, on one level, a test of bravery. It's a test of boundaries. You know, it's a variety of things all at once. And I think that, you know, in that case, it's necessary. And that's why they'll never go away.
I hope not.
No. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I hope they don't go away. Yeah, I agree. I think we need the legends, and we need mythology, because that is how we learn.
Right. Mm-hmm. It ties a lot in with the history. Yeah. You know, the folklore of the way things used to be, legends.
Yeah.
So in your book, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania, you had some interesting stories in there. And one, I looked at, and I thought it was kind of interesting. It says the lost bomber of the Monongahela.
Monongahela.
Monongahela? Yeah.
Monongahela, yes.
And
nothing's easily pronounced around here. I don't know what it is.
It's all Indian names.
Yeah. Yeah, it means falling in banks. That's what that river's name means. That's one of the three rivers that, you know, that merge at Pittsburgh. But that's actually one of my all-time favorite legends. I used to work at the Hyatt History Center in Pittsburgh, which is a Smithsonian affiliate museum. It's one of the 10 largest history museums in the country. And one of the things I did there was research that plane, because they were very interested in it. But I'll tell you the story quickly. It's kind of one of these old conspiracy theories that only recently has gotten more attention. But in 1956, a B-25 bomber that left Nellis Air Force Base, stopped in stopped in Oklahoma, went to Michigan, ultimately was going to Andrews Air Force Base, ran out of gas over Pittsburgh, just past Pittsburgh, had to turn around and come back. The fuel dropped to nothing, so they had to put it down in the Monongahela River. It was January 31st, and the water was like 34 degrees. All right, I take it back. The water was 32. The air temperature was 28. Plane went in. Two of the six people on board died. The other four got out to the shore, and the plane was never found again. And even though they pretended to search for it, it was never found. Or at least I think they pretended. Where they did search, and what happened is, almost immediately, people in Pittsburgh started telling stories about how it was secretly removed at night on the J&L steel mill dock. They pulled it up, cut the wings off it, dropped it on a barge, took it downriver over the dam to the Coast Guard station in Sewickley. And then from there, they drove it out to the Nike Missile Command Center in Oakdale, and it disappeared. There's been speculation for years, and, you know, I've talked to dozens and dozens of people who either saw it removed or their parents claimed, you know, they claimed their parents or grandparents saw it removed. And even though some of the stories you can tell are kind of made up or exaggerated, there's a good core of at least, you know, 30 or 40 accounts. They're all consistent, and they really, you know, describe this thing being removed. And, you know, the thing is, like, as soon as, like, for example, the pilot, when he was pulled out of the river, you know, he had hypothermia. He was pulled out by a tugboat that was passing by. They brought him to the shore. As soon as he got to, like, the dock, there were these two guys in suits waiting for him. They kicked the crew off their boat, including the captain, which, you know, you don't do that to a tugboat captain. But they did. They pushed the pilot, who had hypothermia, back into the cabin. They shut the door, and they debriefed him for, like, 5 or 10 minutes. Before they let him come out, all the nurses at the hospitals got calls saying that no one's allowed to talk to them. You don't ask them any questions that weren't that aren't directly related to their health, and that no one is to speak to them. And then these strange people would show up and talk to them. And you know, the weird thing is, you know, it was like the official purpose of the flight was to transport airplane parts, but the crew consisted of, like, you know, when it took off, there was one guy that got off in Michigan. Originally, it was three majors, like two captains, a couple sergeants, and airmen. But the lowest-ranking guy actually had the highest security clearance of anybody on the plane.
Wow.
So it was kind of a weird flight, taking an old B-25 to pick up parts and all these kind of high-ranking guys. Then, you know, all this weird stuff happened. And the crash report's still blacked out. They have the crash report. It's blacked out. And supposedly the plane was never found. Now, the Mon River is only, it floods at 18 feet. So a B-25 is about 15 to 16 feet high with its landing gears up or down. So it'd be about 13 feet high, 70-foot wingspan, 50 feet long. The river's only 800 feet across. They've never lost anything that big in a river like that, in these rivers here, that they've looked for. They looked for it for weeks and weeks and never officially found it. Supposedly to this day, it's still in the river. Even though I went out with this group called the B-25 Recovery Group, and they think it's still in the river, but they side-scanned sonar the whole river and nothing. And, you know, there were some theories that found this hole on the bottom, but they even checked the hole, and it wasn't in the hole either. And, you know, so years, it's still officially sitting in the river. But again, that's a huge plane. It's not a huge plane as far as planes go, but for that amount of space, they can't go over the dam down in Emsworth. So, you know, to this day, it's still officially there, but there's all these reports of it being pulled out. If you look at, you know, where it came from Nellis, where they were testing in 1956, you know, nuclear weapons, went to Oklahoma, where, you know, they were testing other things, including, you know, but there were still, one thing that people don't realize is there were still chemical and biological weapons testing going on there, even though we signed treaties saying we would do it. You know, more recently has come out, we were still testing in Oklahoma. And then they went to Michigan. They didn't refuel in Michigan, went like they should have, and that's when the fuel died. But there's been all these, you know, theories over the years of what was on board. When we were at the History Center, one of the ideas that they came up with was to see if there were any other documents that this might be mentioned in. You know, official ones are still blacked out. And so we thought to ask for the log of the Coast Guard cutter to help look for the plane. And sure enough, there's this one passage in it where they say they marked the site of the plane, and they called off the search the next night for fog. And then the day after that, they never went back to this. They never mentioned going back to that spot again. They just searched another part of the river.
Huh.
And so, you know, a lot of people think it was removed that night by the government, and whatever was on board was taken off. And I'm sure, you know, by today's standards, this is where, by today's standards, we might think, well, you know, what could be on there? But I think we'd probably be surprised. We'd probably say, well, that was it. They covered that up once we knew what it was, you know? But in the 50s, they just covered everything up because that was standard policy, and especially during the Cold War. And, you know, if you look back at some of the things that have come out now about, you know, there's still a hydrogen bomb sitting off the coast of Georgia somewhere. There's one on the Canary Islands they dropped in the water, you know? All kinds of crazy stuff happened that they just covered up, and they came out recently, or in the past 10, you know, since the Cold War ended. And that's one of my favorite stories. It's still classified. I called the pilot in the year 2000. He was still alive. And as soon as I introduced, I said I was from this history museum, and I was asking very careful questions. Then I said, could I ask you some questions about the plane crash in Pittsburgh? He immediately hung up on me.
Really?
Yeah, only one of the guys was ever allowed to talk about it to the media. There was like one member of that plane that has only had done all the talking. No one else has talked to the media over the years. It's always the same guy on the plane.
Well, had to be something on it that they actually didn't want anybody to know about, whether it was nuclear or whether it was maybe alien or something.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It stopped in so many places. The interesting thing, though, is I know in Oklahoma, it was put in the hangar overnight for repairs on its brakes. But if you look at the repair log, nobody wrote down any repairs on the brakes. Now, it could have been somebody just being negligent, not keeping track in the log, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe it went in the hangar to be loaded with something,
Right.
You never know. But then there were reports of an extra person, or possibly even two extra people, being pulled out of the water that day, too, that weren't in the flight manifest. And so, it gets confusing there, too. And even one of the original researchers of that accident back in the early 80s, he died dying of a heart attack, but at one point his office was ransacked. Later on, after his death, like somebody broke in and searched through his office where he had all his research materials. So it's kind of an interesting story, And it's one of these little conspiracies you don't hear about as often, but still is interesting.
Now, we got a question from the chat room. Is that right?
Yes, we do. We have a question from Tabby for you, Thomas. Tabby asks if you have any hauntings that take place in Central Leah, Pennsylvania, and if you haven't talked about them yet, would you be able to?
Oh, Centralia.
Centralia. Thank you.
Yeah, the burn. I actually, in one of my books, Forgotten Tales of Pennsylvania, I do a brief write-up on Centralia. I actually didn't talk about the hauntings. Ironically, I was interviewed for a documentary about that, about the supposed curse on Centralia.
Mm-hmm.
And Centralia is this town, if you guys don't know, people in Pennsylvania are familiar with it. It's a town that's abandoned because it's burning underground. It's probably going to burn for like 1,000 years. There's a coal fire underground. And the above ground is all destroyed, and there's ruins, and there's smoke and steam comes out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And the fire started in the 60s, but by the early 80s, they had to abandon the town.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the government bought most people out. A handful of people resisted, but it's a really creepy town. The road's closed to it. Its zip code is now 00000.
Oh,
in fact, that's the name of the documentary that's going to be out. On that call. It's just zip code 00000. It's an interesting story. It's actually, the legend of the town is cursed. And what happened is way back in the 1860s or so, 1860s or 70s. 1870s, I guess. The Molly Maguires were active in that area. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they were a group of Irishmen who were kind of labor activists slash thugs that would kind of, go after people that weren't treating the Irish well. But they were kind of like almost like an Irish mafia type group, But they were really just going after employers that were, treating miners badly, but they would use too much force. And they were very active in that region, and the one day, supposedly, the priest was speaking against them and saying that, you don't use violence to get what we want and whatever. And so after a sermon, he walked out of church, and some of the Molly Maguires beat him up. And the priest said, this whole town is going to burn for this, and the last building standing is going to be a church, be this church or be a church. Well, the last building standing in Centralia today is a church. And, the last main functional building in the town proper, now it's not the same church, but it is a church. And, so you can see how that story, nobody can prove that curse actually happened, but that's been part of local lore for years. Mm-hmm. That he cursed six of the Molly Maguires, beat him up. And then the town, the town eventually, lost a lot of its mining, operations and what happened is the dump caught on fire in the late 60s, and it's crept under town. And one kid fell through and almost got burned in the fire one day, is how he found it. In 1981, he just fell through the ground, and luckily he held on, and they pulled him out. But it's kind of a scary thing. I mean, the hole, it's all burning under there. But people do claim there's a ghost there. I know that. I don't have a specific story from it, but I do know people.
Yeah, no, Tavi really likes the answer. And was this Centralia?
We just lost him again, I think.
Oh, no, really?
No, you're still here, right, Thomas?
No, he's not.
Really?
His phone is hung up. But I think it was inspiration for the Resident Evil video game series.
Oh.
Yeah, now he's gone.
All right.
He's been abducted again.
Okay.
It's those darn Pukwudgies.
I think there was another Molly Maguire. Wasn't that the story of just before the gentleman was hanged? He put his hand on the wall of a jail and the handprint's still there? I believe that was one of the Molly Maguires.
All I know is that Molly Maguire's is a bar in Cincinnati.
It's quite a... it was quite a mafia group.
Oh, that's cut me off again. The phone's cut me off. I mean, that might be the government that time when you're talking about the plane.
I don't got it one bit.
I was blaming Pukwudgies since they're in this area.
We've got about 19 minutes, actually about 15 minutes before we start wrapping up.
Yeah.
So,
I actually was curious about the Green Man.
Oh, yeah, that's a great, great Western Pennsylvania urban legend.
Yes.
And because it's a real guy. The Green Man was real, and he turned into a ghost story. But it's really a tragic tale, and it started in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. In 1919, there was a 10-year-old boy named Ray Robinson who climbed up on a trolley trestle. He accidentally grabbed a live wire.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was, I think, 22,000 volt AC, 12,000 DC, I don't know which one it was. But that's what the voltage rates were. So nobody expected him to survive. He was horribly burned. He burned his eyes off, part of his arm away. I actually have a picture of him in the book, a photo by somebody that knew him. And, he's horribly disfigured. And so, they didn't think he would survive, but he did. So he lived with his family, kind of a quiet life. And what happened was he grew up and he would kind of keep to himself. But what he would do for exercise is walk. His family moved from he was burned in Beaver Falls, and they moved up to a town called Coppell.
Mm-hmm.
And he would walk around the property behind his house on these trails. And he'd keep one foot on the trail, one foot off, since he couldn't see. He could feel where he was then. He'd make big loops and exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But after World War II, a strip mining company came and bought all the land behind his house.
Ooh.
And they tore it out during the war, and they strip mined it, so his walking trails were gone. So, he's an adult by that time. So he starts walking on this road called Coppell New Galilee Road at like 10 o'clock at night, thinking nobody will see him.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1950s, you have teenagers with access to cars and free time and spending money really for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these teenagers are out and they start seeing him on the side of the road. Some people think he's an alien. Some people think he's, it becomes kind of this freak show type atmosphere. And they originally called him Charlie No Face. But what happened, though, is that, some people stopped and started talking to him, and when they did, they realized he was a really nice guy, and some people befriended him. And even I heard even Joan Amos stopped and talked to him. Joan Amos was from Beaver Falls. Some of these other people would go past and talk to him or take him beer and cigarettes and sit up there. In fact, at one point, there were like 100 people going up on a Friday or Saturday night to see him. But he'd walk the side of the road. Although some people were still very afraid of him. There was one case where this couple, newlywed couple in 1958, were driving up the side of the road, and they were lost. They couldn't find their hotel, and they saw this guy walking, so they thought they were asking for directions. And they leaned out the window, and they yelled out, "Hey, buddy, can you give us directions to this hotel?" And he answered, but they couldn't hear. So they said, "Can you come closer?" And Ray leaned in the window, and the bride screamed. They initially said she had a heart attack. She probably had a panic attack. And they sped off he took her wife to his wife to the hospital. Later that night, he's on the news being interviewed by a reporter. Anybody from Pittsburgh would recognize the name. Bill Burns was a reporter for decades in Pittsburgh. It was young Bill Burns interviewing him on the side of the road, and the guy was convinced they saw an alien. And, wow. You know, but other people, I got the picture from a guy that used to visit him frequently, and Ray let him take his picture because he was out in the Army, and people didn't believe he knew the real Green Man because people as far away as Chicago and St. Louis had heard of him. But as time went on, you know, some people weren't as nice to Ray, and he was beat up a few times. And eventually, by the early 70s, he kind of stopped walking on the side of the road. And he died in 1985 in a nursing home. But what happened was the legend spread all over Western PA, even into Ohio, like from Youngstown up to, like, Newcastle and Mercer and down to Washington County. And, of course, he was always known as Beaver. They started calling him the Green Man. He said, well, first of all, because he had worn, like, green army jackets.
Okay.
And, some people thought it was because his skin was burned green, but that wasn't true. But he got ascribed to these different places. One famous place that you always see sometimes is made national television shows is the Green Man's Tunnel in South Park. And supposedly, if you drive your car up to that tunnel and blow your horn 3 times, the Green Man will appear or his ghost. And supposedly, there was a guy electrocuted at the tunnel. The story kind of combined. There may have been a real-life electrocution near that tunnel in the past. But what happened is the story of the Green Man got combined with it. Supposedly now he's kind of this like boogeyman that haunts all these different roads in Western PA. And you know, if you call his name or blow the horn 3 times, he'll emerge and chase you off. You know, of course, nobody sticks around that long to,
right.
to find out. But you know, it was one of those things where the legend got told, like people told their grandkids or their kids, and they told their other people, and it kind of got misascribed to various places. But he pops up on a lot of these haunted roads too. Supposedly he's on like Hogback Road and Mercer and Shades of Death in Washington County and various roads in the area. These are all counties around Pittsburgh. And so he kind of became like Western PA's version of the Hook Man. You thought he was actually just this kind of nice guy with a had a tragic accident. But, within one generation, he became a supernatural legend.
Wow. That's the true testament of how quickly folklore can be transmitted. Just through a population. Wow. Yeah, thank you. I had heard about the Green Man, but not that thorough of a explanation.
Now,
yeah, people. Oh, go ahead.
I'm just going to say that you've got lots of good stories with all the books that you've got, which we will never get through tonight. I'm sure that maybe sometime we can get you back on and talk about a whole lot of stuff because there's a book that you have, and we don't have time to get into it now, but it's about witches. And
yes.
A lot of people would really be interested in that. So I'm sure that we'll get you back on and be able to talk about a whole lot more stuff. Everybody really liked you.
Well, thanks.
You guys got some more questions real quick? Like we got about 7 minutes before we start wrapping up here.
I don't have any more questions from the chat room at the moment, no.
What is one of your favorite stories other than the ones that we've talked about so far tonight?
There's a story, I'll do it quickly. It's the Black Cross up in Butler County. It's north of Pittsburgh and West Winterfield. The Black Cross is an old railroad tie cross set back in the woods that marked a mass grave. And that part of Butler County used to have a lot of mines in the early 20th century. The mass grave is a bunch of Italian and Slavic miners who were killed by the Spanish flu in 1918. What happened is, there were so many of them there. The Spanish flu killed lots of people, killed like 5,000 people in Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is. Butler's north of that, and that killed several thousand up there too, and it killed about 300 in this area where this grave marker is. And when they died, nobody could pay for the burial. So the company set aside this piece of land. They started digging these mass graves and put all these bodies in. And there's one, the first one's marked, and the other one was just go back down in the woods. But a priest from Coylesville came over and had a funeral mass and paid for this big black cross out of railroad ties with his own money. And so after, a generation or two passes, in the 50s, teenagers hear about this. They start taking legend trips out there. And it's my favorite ghost story because of the last part. But first of all, a couple things that happen. It's this path, a weird little path that goes back in the woods. And when you go back there, one of the things is the stories is that the trees start to reach in at you, almost like they slowly creep and reach the branches. And of course, you know, under a full moon, you might hear the babies crying of the, you know, the parents they lost, or maybe it's the ghosts of the babies that are buried there. Mm-hmm. Of course, most of the flu victims die in October and November, so it's conveniently time for Halloween. And but the best part of the story is, you know, it's really like you get back there. It's not that far from the road, but it's a very isolated road anyway. You get back there, you get really close to the ground, and you listen. You're supposed to be able to hear the ghost speaking.
Oh, wow.
But they're speaking in Italian. You know, most ghosts convert to English upon death, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I think it's funny. You hear these, you know, 500-year-old German castles, and they're speaking English to you. They actually have the right language, you know? The other weird things happen. Like, sometimes there'll be the zone of silence there where people go down there and try to talk, and no noise will come out. Weird things. That legend actually almost died out for a while. By the 1980s, 1990s, people couldn't even find it. The Black Cross had kind of crumbled. And a local women's group put a historical marker there in a small concrete cross, but nobody could find it. People had kind of forgotten about it. But what brought the legend back, kind of got it on the internet again, was the bird flu and swine flu scares around 2004, 2005.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It went, you know, you remember they kept comparing it to the 1918 flu? They told everybody they were going to die. It was going to be like 1918 flu, and that killed young people, you know. And I was trying to track that legend on the internet at the time, and there was almost no information about it. But once those, you know, within about 6 months of those bird flu scares, people started saying, oh, yeah, that reminds me of this story. And then suddenly that legend popped up, and then it was everywhere. And all the, like, the local ghost hunting groups out here all make trips out there to the Black Cross. It's kind of one of those instances where it was a great ghost story to begin with, and then, you know, situations kind of brought it back. It kind of defied the death of the legend, you know, mm-hmm. survived because of things going on in culture. So,
wow,
it's one of my favorite places. I mean, there's a lot of great places out here. Folklorists in the 70s did a study, and they traced the way folklore moved across the country. And, of course, the stuff in the deep south stayed down there, and the stuff that originated down the California coast stayed over there. But everything else funneled through one point. Like all the traditions from New England and the mid-Atlantic states, and everything funneled all one direction through one place, and that place was Pittsburgh. They traced it out on the map. It all came through western Pennsylvania, and then it went down the Ohio Valley and spread out back across the country again. A whole variety of different folk traditions. And so here in Western PA, we have hundreds and hundreds of ghost stories. Every October, somebody tells me 20 or 30 more I've never heard of.
Wow.
And, there's so much tradition here. And if you know anything about, like, the Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, like, we have this diaspora of Steelers fans everywhere. But that's mm-hmm. how they are with stuff from Pittsburgh in general. And it's kind of a unique city in that way where, like, in Western PA, people hold on to these traditions. And, like, you can, you know, get stuff from four or five generations ago that would have died out elsewhere. And somebody's mm-hmm. still carrying that tradition here. So it makes it a great place to study folklore, to look in these legends.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Well, now, speaking of ghost stories, have you been to different places around, like maybe Hillview Manor over in Newcastle?
Actually, that's one of the places around here I haven't been to, Hillview Manor. So many people went up there and told me about it. I know people who used to work there. I know some people that get lots of firsthand accounts. That's one of the places I haven't written about and haven't gone up to. I've been meaning to at some point or another, but what I often try to do is find the legends that people don't know about yet, or find the ones that have kind of slipped through the cracks or haven't been written about yet or aren't as well. I mean, certainly somebody's well known, you know. But I often, since there's so many people interested in Hillview Manor, it's supposed to be a very active place from what I understand. And I know people used to work there that had weird experiences. But one of the few places in Western PA I haven't spent much time at all. But you guys were there, so.
Yeah, we've been there, I don't know, three or four times.
Yeah.
We go there and do the show and different things like that. So we'll get to investigate then after that, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Tell you, our time is just flying right on by, and you've got so many books. What I want you to do is I want you to give out all your information about all your books, where people can get them, and how they can get a hold of you, and all the good information. And then we're going to want you to stay on till after we're off, and then we'll thank you and after the show.
Okay, yeah. My books are all available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. My newest one is Haunted Roads of Western Pennsylvania, and there's also Supernatural War of Pennsylvania, Ghosts, Monsters, and Miracles, Witches of Pennsylvania, Ghosts of Southwestern Pennsylvania, Gangs and Outlaws of Western Pennsylvania, if you like that, Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. I have a series of books, Forgotten Tales. They're Forgotten Tales of Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania. And they're all available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or at the History Press / Arcadia. They've merged now, so they're one company. And I can be reached, either just look me up at Duquesne University, that's spelled D-U-Q-U-E-S-N-E, and my, you'll find my email there, or I have a Facebook page, and I have a Facebook page for two of my books, which is a Pennsylvania, it's probably the easiest one to find, and then Legends of Lore of Western Pennsylvania. And I'm always willing to hear stories and talk to people about any of this stuff.
Excellent.
And thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, no, it's been our pleasure. People's really enjoyed your stories. So that's what we like. So what we'll do is we'll see about setting a date up, get you back again.
I do have to ask you one quick question, though. And that, has anybody come to you and asked about the Blair Witch, thinking that it was real?
Actually, I have a funny story about that. I knew somebody that was trying to investigate that years ago. They saw, remember the fake documentary about Blair Witch?
Mm-hmm.
It was on TV, you remember, before the movie came out. And they became obsessed with it. They were calling the sheriff down there and everything. And it was pretty funny, actually. But I'm sure not for the people down there. But yeah, I mean, people have in the past, back then, asked about that, but not recently.
Excellent. Kat, I'm going to let you do Jeff's job and give out all of our information.
All right. Well, I'll give you what I can get my hands on. So first off, you can follow us on Twitter at the Paraview Radio, and you can follow me at Kat Cloco, by the way. You can also email us at theparanormalview@gmail.com. You can visit our website, theparanormalview.com, and also visit our Facebook page, which is a community, not the magazine, and I believe it's facebook.com/theparanormalview. That I did not have ready, so.
Well, that's okay.
And
I can find it. It's community, so it'll come up at,
Yep. So.
And we have, Barbara, you're on Facebook.
Facebook and Twitter. Look up Ellen Smithy, you'll find me.
And, she puts up all kinds of pictures of cemeteries, statues and stuff. Does a great job with those.
Yes. Wait, I didn't do my stuff.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, you can go to my author webpage, which is katcloco.com. That's KatCloCKOW. Or you can follow the fantasy adventure that I write, graphic novel series at jinxedcomic.com. Just jinxedcomic.com, at jinxedcomic on Twitter. And you can see me at this year's Rhode Island Comic Con 2015 from November 6th to the 8th at the Rhode Island Convention Center in Providence, Rhode Island.
Very good. Very good. Next week, you can tune in. We have Michael Varhola, and we'll be talking about his book, Ghost Hunting San Antonio and the Texas Hill Country. So that'll be great with that. We've had him on a couple times. He's a great author. And we hope everybody will have a great rest of the weekend. I know some places has already seen some snow. And it's supposed to get fairly cold here tonight, down in the low 30s. And not very warm tomorrow either. So Anyway, we hope everybody else has a great great weekend. We're just about out of here. This is Henry Foister.
Barb Duncan.
And Kat Kloko.
And we will see you next week at the same time, as soon as I find the right thing here. Ah, there it is. Good night, everybody.
Don't do that.
You've been listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. Join us again next week at the same time for more of The Paranormal View.